Hello and welcome to Mon the Workers, a podcast by the SDUC. I'm Rachel Thompson.
And I'm Karina Liptroth. And in this episode, we are discussing the proposed closure of Grangemouth Oil Refinery and the impact it would have and how this plays into the just transition.
We are currently outside Grangemouth Oil Refinery, which is a significant landmark in Scotland's industrial landscape. With its distinctive gas flares and cooling towers visible across the Scottish lowlands, Grangemouth has been more than just a refinery. It's a symbol of Scotland's industrial history. Owned by PetroEneos, a joint venture between PetroChina and Ineos, the refinery has been a vital hub for processing oil and gas from the Forties pipeline system in the North Sea for nearly a century. However, PetroEneos has recently proposed to cease operations as soon as 2025.
This decision will affect 500 jobs at the refinery alone, with wider impacts on the local supply chain. Grangemouth's closure would have far-reaching consequences, not just locally, but also nationally. The proposed closure of the refinery is symbolic of the changes at play in our energy system and economy, with major decisions of pivotal sites being taken by multinationals and workers responding with their plans for the future.
As we delve into the implications of the Grangemouth Refinery's potential closure, we'll explore its legacy, the challenges ahead, and the ripple effects it's likely to have on the community and beyond. Join us as we delve into the past, present, and future of the Grangemouth Oil Refinery.
We took some time in Grangemouth to speak to some people who lived in the area, and this is what their thoughts are on the closure.
Grangemouth is known for that, so the whole town itself quieting down dramatically, and obviously there'll be a loss of business, not just for there, it'll be other places as well.
See, I was an employee, but all my colleagues that still work down there are devastated. They're worried about the houses getting repossessed.
Like the jobs, they'll just be gone in Grangemouth soon enough. The small businesses around here are closing, so when it comes to jobs around here, it's just getting tougher and tougher for young people.
We're joined by Unite convener Chris Hamilton. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris, would you like to tell us a bit more about your role in Unite and in Grangemouth?
Yep, I am currently the plant convener here at the PetroEneos Grangemouth Refinery. As well as that, I am a plant operator, one of probably 200-odd plant operators we have here. And as my role as convener, I'm dealing with the business and the management and the normal sort of workplace issues we've got, but clearly, in light of this transition announcement, we're dealing with the campaign around about that.
So how much involvement has Unite had with the negotiations with PetroEneos?
Yeah, well, I mean, Unite, as the recognised trade union on the site, has always had an active role in terms of the daily business on site. So we were notified 30 minutes before the wider workforce on the 21st of November 2023. Up to that point, we were unaware of the announcement to transition away from an oil refinery to a terminal. But since the announcement was made, we have been engaging with the business regularly, looking at understanding what the proposals are, understanding what we can do to potentially extend or continue the operations at Grangemouth. But clearly the focus for us is maintaining and protecting the jobs that are reliant on the site at present.
How do your members feel about the potential closure and what's the impact on them?
Well, I mean, as you would understand, everybody's clearly nervous, everyone's clearly, it's a worrying time for the workers here at Grangemouth. It's worth saying that it's not just for the members that I represent as the direct employees, but also the indirect employees such as contractors and the wider supply chain. But I mean, the majority of the workforce here are local as well, so we are worried about the impact this will have on the wider Grangemouth and Falkirk community. But yeah, but it's definitely an unsettling time.
What would be the ideal outcome from these negotiations?
What we would like to see ultimately is maintaining the jobs that we've got there at present. I mean, this is a highly skilled workforce. So in the first instance, we would like to see any outcome that would keep and maintain, and you could actually argue to improve and increase the number of people employed at site. But in the short term, we need the refinery to continue its operation, because without that, we've not really got a future. But the sort of medium to long term, we are going to need the business and, I suppose, the two governments to look at how we transition.
Have you seen many changes within your time working at Grangemouth?
Well, I've been here for about 11 years this year. I'm one of many local people who work here, and like many, I come through the apprenticeship scheme. So I left school, come straight into here, but as a local resident, I've always clearly been aware of the site and the opportunities that the site presents. But The actual Grangemouth complex itself is split today into three different businesses. We've got the Petronios, which is the oil refinery where I work, and that's the part that's it's in the media at present about the transition project. There's Ineos O&P, which is the petrochemical plant, and there is Ineos FPS, which is the Kinneil terminal where it's associated with the Forties pipeline. So there is three different businesses today at Grangemouth, but clearly the impact in terms of contribution that all three have got to this area and to the wider economy is massive. Mm-hmm.
There have been a few suggestions about what could happen in the future here, including hydrogen, power, biofuels. What would be the most preferred outcome for that, and do you have any confidence that that would happen?
In terms of the specifics, we would at Grangemouth like to see basically all of the above in respect to keeping the jobs and the manufacturing capacity we've got here at present. I mean, there has been a lot of interest, and it is in public domain, that there are options, and I refer to the Grangemouth Future Industries Board, which has been discussing, for example, potentially biorefining capacity on the site. So we would like to see all of that, and we hope there is a future at Grangemouth which features all of that stuff. But the problem we've got at present is the frustration that whilst in 2025, potentially, the site could seize manufacturing capacity, and this stuff potentially 2030 and or beyond, means there is, of course, a gap. And therefore, that gap for us means job losses, and it means that devastation that I alluded to in terms of the impact it would have on the wider community. I mean, just 3% of the workforce at present think they've got confidence in the so-called just transition going forward. So these plans, whilst we welcome them, we're of course a wee bit sceptical in terms of timeframes they'll be delivered on and the jobs that could potentially be associated with them.
So Chris, for you as the Unite convener, what's next?
In the short term, we'll obviously be continuing to work with the business and work with the two governments, hopefully, to come for a solution to the problem we're facing at present. But for Unite as a whole, we're going to be launching an oil and gas campaign, hopefully, this month. We've already done a bit of work in terms of within the perimeters of the gates, and we've engaged with the workers at the refinery, but our focus now clearly turns to the community here in Grangemouth in the Falkirk district. So in the near future we will be coming out with how the public can support our campaign, whether that's petitions, whether it's attending rallies, whether it's writing to politicians, for example, because there's absolutely no doubt that we will need the support from the wider community. And therefore, when the time comes, I would urge people, whether it's sharing things on social media and or taking part in some of the campaign materials, that would be greatly appreciated.
Okay, thank you so much for your time.
So yesterday we met with Chris over at Grangemouth Oil Refinery and we discussed the proposed closure of the refinery. Today we're joined by Miriam Brett and Ewan Gibbs. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Yes, thanks so much for having me here. My name's Miriam, I'm a co-director at Future Economy Scotland.
My name's Ewan Gibbs, I'm a lecturer in economic and social history, and recently I've been completing a study on the announced closure at Grangemouth with PhD researcher Ryoko Shibe for the Just Transition Commission.
We're also joined by our Just Transition Officer, Ryan.
Hello, yes, I'm Ryan, I'm the Just Transition Officer at the STUC.
Ewan, would you like to say a bit about the research you've been carrying out recently?
Yeah, so we've done interviews with around eight workers at Grangemouth so far, and they come from a range of positions across the refinery, petrochemicals complex and professional service workers, as well as from the contracting staff who make up a large portion of the workforce. I think one of the most important features of our findings so far is just marked uncertainty about what the future holds, a sense that the workforce was not consulted on these very important decisions about their future, about the future of the town of Grangemouth that Watson live in, but also about the future of a site that's crucial, I think, across a wider industrial labour market across the Scottish Central Belt. None of the workers that we spoke to are in principle hostile to climate, you know, they're not climate change deniers, they're not hostile to the idea of an energy transition. They think that they have important skills that could actually be part of a renewable energy economy. The younger workers we've spoke to accept this is a transformation that's going to happen over their lifetimes. The older workers are prepared to play a constructive role in transition and even consider some form of phased redundancy if that was possible, but that's not been what's been on offer to them at the moment, and they don't know what the future holds. And I think that's an extreme point in a larger set of circumstances that's unfolding across Scotland's energy economy and arguably Scotland's economy as a whole when it comes to a sense of powerlessness or a lack of voice for workers who are meant to be central to this transformation.
Ryan, as the Just Transition Officer, you've obviously been keeping a very keen eye on this. What are your thoughts about what's happening?
The context we have just now is the Scottish Government is in the middle of an energy strategy process. They are at the beginning of a process of developing a Just Transition Plan for Grangemouth. And what we're expecting and what we're seeing is far from answering those specific questions. And so when we go to look at these things, what we see is a lack of detail that can give workers any confidence in what's about to unfold. And there's a real, I think, an increasing evidence now that actually that those are questions that the Scottish Government isn't necessarily even trying to address. And it's a real fundamental difference in our understanding of Just Transition, which is about confidence, security and the power that workers have over what is going to happen to their livelihoods, versus something from the Scottish Government which is much more focused on opening up business opportunities, creating avenues for companies to step in and do different things. And you know, those are partly considerations that we need to have, but what's important is what happens to workers in between those stages, what happens to workers here and what happens to their jobs as they move forward.
So what are sort of the big steps that you guys would like to see the Scottish Government do regarding Grangemouth?
I think in the immediacy we need some sort of employment guarantee. Grangemouth is a crucial industrial hub. It's a centre of training and apprenticeships that are regarded as stellar in the context of the larger energy sector in Scotland. If those jobs and that activity is allowed to go, then the hopes for a just transition are going to be severely diminished. I think even the prospect of those jobs going is already severely diminishing those hopes.
Yeah, I agree with the need to transition that and do so in a way that the impacted community is not negatively affected by that, that it's focused on reskilling and retraining, which were, you know, pretty much absent from the immediate kind of the releases around the immediate decisions there, that workers in the community are also given a meaningful stake and say in what happens to the future of that refinery and how it transitions. Because, you know, done well, a just transition can create more jobs than we currently have. It's just, it's, you know, we are transitioning just now. It's just, it's being coordinated very poorly. And actually, you know, there's an opportunity there to create shared goals, to have a coordinated approach, to create good green jobs that actively raise living standards and tackle inequalities. And so there is an opportunity here. It's just being missed, and as a result, workers and communities are being let down by the lack of, you know, coordinated green industrial strategy that's actually required. And I think picking up on Ewan's point there around the role of the state, I think it's important to look at this decision in Grangemouth in the context of its history as well. Like, you know, the fact that they were going to, you know, annihilate pensions in, I think it was 2008, the 2013 compromises that had to be made by the workforce around pay freezes, around, you know, lack of full-time union reps, around, you know, there were serious compromises that had to be made. And now with this decision here, and I think last year there was also pay disputes, and, you know, what I think that demonstrates that so much of this is a struggle of capital and corporate power and the power that they have over workers. And I think there's a disconnect there, because for communities that have been embedded in an industry often for generations, in this case, you know, when you see this in steel and oil as well, it's so much a part of their like collective identity, and I think they feel like a sense of ownership over that, and that runs in such sharp contrast to, you know, some billionaire on a yacht determining their future, that actually they're the ones that have put into this and they're the ones that should be getting back from it, getting something back from it. So yeah, I think this, the kind of the fact that governments are now scrambling to try and pick up the pieces here, which is the reality of this, and I don't think either government is doing everything that they can and should do, but the fact that they're now scrambling to pick up the pieces after, you know, corporate decisions have been made here is sadly quite emblematic of the state of industry. And yeah, I think Just Transition, it presents an opportunity to reimagine the ownership of future industries as well, and the kind of stake and say that people have in that, and to look at democratic alternatives to what we currently have, so that, you know, as we transition to a green economy, we're not replicating the extractive, you know, business models where shareholders and executives excessively benefit while, you know, workers are left at the sharp end and communities communities and workers are left in the sharp end.
Can I quickly add something to that, which is really important? I think it's worth, as Miriam says, thinking about the long-term trajectory there, that for most of its life, certainly from the 1920s when the refinery was first established into the 1980s, Grangemouth was owned by BP at a time when BP was a majority publicly owned company. As Miriam said, it had well-recognised trade unions that were integrated in many ways into the life of the refinery. After BP was privatised, it then sold the refinery to Ineos and gradually the rest of the complex as well. That came with, as many have mentioned, the 2013 dispute, the derecognition of the union. These are all things that weaken the context of a just transition and a more democratic economy. But I think it's also important to think about some of the things that maybe happened after that as well. In particular, in the refinery, there was a restructuring in 2020. And so there's already been several hundred jobs lost in the refinery in recent years. That was blamed on the poor oil price at the time. But since then, as we know, the oil price has rebounded and Ineos have made billions of pounds in profit. But that's not what the workers are seeing here. So and I think that's also important when we think about the context of the discussion of a just transition, because Ineos aren't making these decisions in the name of a transition to a green economy. They're making them in the name of profit, and they intend to continue to make billions of pounds out of the oil and gas economy. And I think that's quite important for the tenor of the political discussion around what's happening at Grangemouth and the wider Scottish economy as well.
And I think just to add to that as well, the kind of, you know, there were some knee-jerk reactions from some saying, this is because the transition's happening too fast, this is why they've done this, you know. And actually, in reality, over 100 new oil and gas, North Sea oil and gas licences were issued, you know, in the run-up to this decision being made. In sharp contrast to what the International Energy Agency said, you know, to stay within the safe limits of warming, we cannot open new oil and gas fields. And the UK government made the decision to open, you know, provide over 100 new licences for North Sea oil and gas, and this decision was still made. So the notion that this is because, you know, there's this, you know, imaginary, in my eyes, political consensus against oil and gas is absolutely nonsense. It is, because the transition is happening, it's just happening really slowly and it's poorly coordinated. And so workers and communities are left to grapple with that. And I think just pick up on the point on energy security as well, because this is something that's been kind of raised there within the context of the new licences being opened in the North Sea, where, you know, some are saying, particularly with, you know, Russia's war in Ukraine, saying there's a need to kind of enhance Britain's domestic energy security through opening up new oil and gas fields. And actually, kind of, firstly, oil and gas fields take around, you know, 28 years to start producing fossil fuels, so that's going to take us well beyond the UK government's 2050 target. Secondly, you know, as we decarbonise and housing and transport and energy, etc., there's a drop in demand for oil and gas, and, you know, in turn, there's less demand for oil and gas imports. And I think, lastly and crucially, touches upon the point of ownership that was discussed there, is that there's a notion that the oil and gas produced or extracted in the North Sea is Britain's. And it's farcical, actually. You know, it hasn't been for decades. And actually, if you look at the ownership makeup of who owns oil and gas licences in the North Sea basin, it's increasingly private equity firms. Of course, you've got multinational corporations in there, but also increasingly state-owned enterprises. So China, Russia, and UAE, China, Norway, UAE, for example, like, they're all kind of present in that. So, yeah, I think there's a really kind of bad faith narrative put forward, firstly, about the notion that this is in response to climate action, and secondly, that's tied to the need for new oil and gas fields is tied to energy security.
When we visited Grangemouth yesterday, I didn't realise that the refinery is literally, like, in the town. the high street is like a very, very short walk from the refinery, and it's so big. It covers such a huge area. In an ideal situation, how would you expect the just transition to take place and for that space to be actually used in a good way?
I think we've seen proposals from across the site of what the transition opportunities might be, and we heard from Chris about the support and the enthusiasm from workers at the refinery and elsewhere across the complex at those opportunities, looking at potentially around hydrogen but also around biofuels. One of the things that's difficult here is that the context of this conversation is the proposed closure of the oil refinery, but these proposals are coming from elsewhere in the site, and the kind of complicated structure that Ineos and Petroneos have set up means that those are not necessarily tied together in a way that we would sit here now and think, okay, well, if you're looking at transition opportunities, what about those 500 workers whose jobs are potentially at risk from the refinery? The proposal there is for potentially a closure as early as 2026, but all of the other avenues that the site is looking at in terms of transition into low carbon production are potentially 2030 onwards, if not later, and those aren't necessarily even secured in terms of looking at what investments needed there as well. So what you see as a cliff edge for the workers at the refinery, while there is the potential that the site does transition into other production at a later date elsewhere across the site. And one of the things that we have noted is across the energy sector just now, particularly in some of the renewables industry, is there's a real demand from companies for skills, real demand for skilled workers to come in, and essentially a crisis point as renewable generation is really going to expand, particularly offshore wind explode through things like ScotWind in the next, across the rest of the decade. But then again, what's difficult here is you're seeing workers being having their jobs threatened, the skills that they have there, and they're not necessarily picked up and talked about as, well, actually, those are the workers that you need in order to take forward that work. And that comes back to the questions that we've mentioned already in terms of, well, what protections are in place and how are those transition opportunities opened up. But it also comes back to, well, are these companies prepared to make the work decent? Are they prepared to pay appropriate wages? Are they prepared to give people the security they need instead of working on, you know, a contracting basis, giving people very little security in their livelihood? And that's where we come back in terms of what the industry is saying about the need for jobs and skills. And what we're saying is, if you make those jobs attractive, if you put them out there to people who are already in the energy sector, then people will take them on. People are interested in these opportunities, but we're not seeing any of that. When we're talking about the big steps that Miriam and Ewan both mentioned, control and ownership, and that's something that's been very revealing in this process and in this announcement, is essentially we've looked at an announcement coming from Ineos, a joint venture Ineos has with PetroChina. And so when we're thinking about big steps, what we're also thinking about is not just what happens in that specific site, but how do we avoid this happening, and how do we make sure we're retaining the maximum benefit from the alternative industries in a way that we're not seeing just now? And I think Ewan's research before has brought in the ownership question and the scale of public intervention. And I think there was a really interesting piece of research there around Dounreay, the nuclear site and the far north. The extent to which we had the public sector involved in that was that, you know, you built up the area, we had housing and local infrastructure like schools established there. But beyond that, the UK Energy Authority, the UK Atomic Energy Authority, was running the local rec centre, the local pub and social centre. That was the extent of public sector involvement we have. And you compare that with today, where, you know, even from the Scottish Government, we're seeing the ScotWind process, a huge, potentially 29 gigawatts of offshore wind energy, which is absolutely massive, being handed entirely to non-publicly controlled companies in Scotland. The Irish Investment Bank has significant stakes in a couple of those projects. The Scottish National Investment Bank has nothing. There's a real question there about how can you retain the benefits, how can you prioritise those social goals through a just transition without that control?
Can I come in on that? That's okay. I'd highlight that historian Linda Ross has done great work on the history of Dounreay and the construction of a new community around the atomic plant. And I think whatever we think about nuclear power, and I expect there'll be varying views in the listenership here, it's a really important example of state intervention, and also an intervention that helped to reverse the depopulation of a part of the Highlands that had experienced the loss of people across the 19th and 20th centuries. The other point I wanted to make was about wind. Specifically, some of the contract workers that we've spoken to have mentioned, for instance, that Grangemouth is on the NECI agreement, the construction blue book deal, which guarantees relatively good paying conditions, whereas the wind farm developments that some of them have worked on generally aren't. There's also a problem with portability when it comes to skills and qualifications between the oil and gas sector and our carbon intensive sectors. So I interviewed workers that were made redundant from Rolls-Royce's plant in Shinnin a couple of years ago, and they were highly skilled aerospace engineers that had actually paid for their own tickets, as they call them, in some cases, to go and work offshore, were unable to find work. I think the other thing I would highlight is, I know recently the Scottish Government has emphasised that actually it looks like the wind workforce is considerably bigger than we thought it was a couple of years ago. Nevertheless, the employment is overwhelmingly concentrated in temporary construction jobs, and that is a problem in terms of building a durable industrial base. One of the really important things about Grangemouth is it's provided dependable work for families for decades and even generations, as Miriam mentioned, and it's not sustainable to argue that we can have an industrial future based on simply throwing up wind turbines one after another that have been produced elsewhere and hope that that'll continue into the, you know, evergreen future.
If anyone's listening who isn't taking part already, how can anyone get involved to support the campaign and the cause and to make their opinion known as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think we obviously have our own Just Transition project here at the STUC, and really what we're trying to encourage is we're bringing as much attention as we can to the work that's already underway across Scotland, where we are seeing workers who are recognising both the opportunity and the risks in their sectors and are starting to plan for what that alternative future could look like. We've seen it with people who work in the offshore energy sector. We've also seen it here at Grangemouth, where the workers are beginning to develop their own plan, as we heard from Chris, about what should happen instead. We've spoke to workers in the automotive industry who see potential changes from the move away from combustion vehicles and to other forms of production. And really, that's where the hope and the inspiration is coming from in this. And what we are trying to do as the STUC is provide support where we can, bring attention to that as much as possible. So if people are looking for ways to stay involved, I'd say try and stay as up to date as possible with the project. Look out for the things that we are talking about. When there are chances to get involved and show support for those workers, then absolutely take them. I think Chris has mentioned that there's likely to be some opportunities for that in the local area, but also on a national level elsewhere. And that's similar for us as well. I think that the second part to that is some of the political context of this. So on top of supporting workers that are taking on action already on these issues, but like we've mentioned, public ownership, the role of the public sector, the type of guarantees that workers need to make sure the transition is just, is an important thing that everyone can do, no matter where they are. We have brought specific attention to things like local authority energy ownership as an example. What are local authorities doing? And there's huge divergence there between, you know, you might see Aberdeen Shire running huge megawattage that it owns compared to, you know, we look at Inverclyde, which has barely anything. There's no real distinction there other than and what opportunities there are. And we might see, the other example would be Stirling Council, which has a huge solar panel program into its social housing. They've cut people's bills in social homes. They've built up a local supply chain of that industry, and they've managed to bring in additional revenue to the council through that. That's the kind of topic that we're looking at, and how can we promote that elsewhere? So again, I'd encourage people to just keep an eye on both of those things, both the political and the workplace support that can be done.
I'd advise your listeners, particularly those from Grangemouth or who have a working relationship to the complex, to keep an eye on the activities the Just Transition Commission is running. I'm still willing to speak to any workers who want to speak to me, and I'm happy to do that on an anonymous basis rather than on a named basis in terms of the reporting of the research. And there will be a report that myself and Ryoko will write for the Commission, which will be released soon, and we'll be in touch about that through the Just Transition Commission when it's released. So please keep an eye on us.
We do have a Just Transition mailing list, so we'll put the link in the bio for that. So please join, and that's where you'll get the news first. Thank you so much, Mary Minion, for visiting and telling us your story. It's really appreciated. And Ryan, thanks so much for joining us as well. Thanks for listening to Mon the Workers, a podcast by the Scottish Trades Union Congress. Today's episode was presented by Karina Lipdrott and Rachel Thompson. To find out more about the STUC, visit our social media, where our username is @ScottishTUC.